It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh Public Schools Board tabled a plan to close schools. District administrators had proposed closing six buildings over 2 years to chip away at the district's $39 million deficit. Board President Sylvia Wilson joins us now. Welcome to the Confluence.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
When Superintendent Anthony Hamlet first suggested closing six schools, what ran through your mind?
That there will be panic in the street.
Parents don't like to hear that.
No one likes to hear that. No one likes to hear it.
I assume also taxpayers don't like to hear their taxes are going to be raised to close that deficit.
Well, you're absolutely correct. The next issue is I don't close schools, but don't raise my taxes.
The vote was 7-1 to table the proposal last Tuesday, and it was a proposal to open up for public comment, not on the closing itself. You abstained from that vote. Why?
I think it was just too much confusion. I know that people heard that this was going to be discussed, and they immediately started bombarding us with phone calls and emails and telling everybody that you're not closing our schools. I think that it wasn't very clear to the public. It was not to vote on the actual closing of the schools. It was to actually begin a discussion so that people could understand what was going on. And I just thought it was just so confusing that I just decided to abstain. I very rarely abstain.
Is it because the proposal was to open it up for public comment, public hearings, but the plan was already out there and we're going to comment on the plan, or we would like to start from scratch and comment on the whole concept of whether to close schools?
You had both. You had both. There are some people who were very upset to hear that these were even being proposed without some discussion prior to that. Then there were others that said, I don't want you to tell us which schools should close. No matter what you say, let us make that decision. It just came out wrong. It wasn't a smooth process like it was expected. A bit chaos is exactly what was created.
City councilors Ricky Burgess and Daniel Lavelle are sponsoring a resolution declaring, quote, a state of educational emergency, seeking a conversation with district officials. You responded by saying the board wants to talk to council about letting the district keep $20 million of annual earned income tax credit. This started back under Act 47 when the city was in financial distress. Do you think this conversation, if you have it, will actually change anything?
It may not, but to be quite honest, we've had this conversation already with the mayor. Last year, actually, we discussed it. And actually, the school board has been asking about this for 4 years, at least that I'm aware of, because the city is no longer in distress. So why are they still removing that money from the school district? It doesn't help our financial situation at all.
Yes, the city was in Act 47 from December of 2003, and they left in February of 2018. The big hole in the budget was discovered late in the fall. I mean, it was projected there was going to be. Options were considered, including closings to make up the deficit. The board tabled that, as we said, at least tabled consideration for public comment. But the deficit isn't going anywhere. So what's the plan?
Well, that's going to have to be something to be decided. The public wasn't happy to hear close. And that's why the discussion has to be more than, well, let's look at these schools that we're going to consider closing. We know there's a deficit. We don't want schools to close, but we don't want their taxes raised either. We know we're going to have a lot more public comment. It's going to come. I don't think that it makes any sense for people to say, just don't close my school. If they want to come up with some great solutions for consideration, that's what should happen. But in the long run, it may end up being something that's not happy for everyone.
Do you have any hope of getting that money from the city? We're talking about not trying to recover what money was given to the city.
That was already done. We're not talking about retroactive. We're talking about just plain moving forward. To be quite honest, when we talked to the legislators, because this was a legislative action, they said, quite frankly, it would have something to do with the mayor agreeing to it. When we met with the mayor, it was quite obvious that mayor wasn't very thrilled about making that change because they're actually using the money now to balance their own budget. So I don't know how realistic it's going to be, but that certainly is a consideration.
Your colleague, Board Member Pam Harbin, noted that 60% of the students enrolled in the schools that were proposed for closure are Black. Do you see a way of addressing the budget deficit without disproportionately affecting kids of color?
Considering that Pittsburgh Public Schools is just about the majority Black, wherever, whatever schools you're going to look at, that's what you're going to find. That's what I see.
So what do you think happens next? As we said, the deficit isn't going anywhere. How's the district going to survive? How is it going to move forward?
Well, the one thing that I hate to see may happen is programs will be cut, which actually benefit our students, but there may be program cuts. There may be teacher layoffs. They may have to, you know, consolidate some of these schools in some ways. And it's the things that we don't want to see, but it may end up coming to that point.
Pittsburgh Public Schools Board President Sylvia Wilson, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Allegheny County Jail used a chair restraint more than 300 times in 2019. That's twice as much as any other county correctional facility in the Commonwealth, according to data from the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. Juliet Ryle is a reporter at publicsource.org. She has published a story on the use of chair restraints at the county jail. Juliet, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
All right, Juliet, first of all, give us a brief description. What is a chair restraint and why do jails use it?
Sure. So restraint chairs were invented in 1990. They were seen as a safer alternative to a four-point restraint, which was previously used. That was when someone was restrained to a bed by their arms and legs. And so these chairs were invented so that inmates or sometimes people in hospital settings could be transported safely and in some cases restrained safely if they were acting unruly or in danger of harming themselves or other people. Mm-hmm. People in the chair are restrained by their wrists, their ankles, their arms, and their shoulders.
So it's meant to keep someone from harming themselves?
The original intent was to keep people safe, both staff members and the person themselves. But of course, there is a lot of potential for abuse with something like this.
So how does this compare to how Allegheny County Jail uses it?
Allegheny County Jail used this device 339 times in 2019. That is over double what the next highest facility used it. Folks are really divided on how it's used and why. So if you talk to people who have been in the chair and some medical professionals who've worked at the jail, they say that it is inhumane, it violates people's rights, and is sometimes used as a form of punishment. Mm-hmm. However, if you talk to other medical professionals and correctional experts, some feel that it is necessary for the safety of both the person in the chair and the staff working with them.
You did speak with formerly incarcerated people and former jail employees. Why do they think it was used so often? As punishment or something else?
Well, it really depends on the person. Mm-hmm. One person I spoke to, Kimberly, told me about her experience in the chair. She's been in the chair at least 6 times, as she estimates. And she felt like it was always used as punishment and as a replacement or an alternative to providing her with mental health treatment. And she felt that whenever she was having a crisis, the chair was always the first thing that the jail did. And she was often left in it, she says, for hours without bathroom breaks, without being given food or water, sometimes naked or with a blanket over her that would fall down so that she would be exposed to passersby. Now, we also spoke to folks who have worked in the mental health units at the jail who say that, you know, while this may be unpleasant and while there is potential for abuse and you have to use it judiciously, one doctor, a psychiatrist, Dr. Halber in particular, told me that sometimes on the acute mental health units, it wasn't used in situations where it should have been, because people were, you know, breaking the lights in their cells and could cut themselves or other very dangerous situations.
20 counties in the state don't use the restraint chairs. So did you get any word from Allegheny County why they continue to use it?
The county actually didn't respond to our requests for comment on this story. At the jail oversight board meeting Thursday, after this story published, there was a robust discussion about the use of the restraint chair at the jail, and several board members, Bethany Hallam, Chelsea Wagner, called for more data on the use of the restraint chair at the jail, how it's being used for people with mental health diagnoses.
So are you saying that the jail oversight board is not getting the information they need or say they feel they need?
Well, that's certainly been an ongoing conversation at these board meetings. Back in September, Bethany Hallam, who's on the board, requested that the jail provide the board unredacted copies of all of its policies, which by state statute, the board has a right to have. At that time, the warden said that the board could not have unredacted copies of the policies. They could only see redacted copies. On Thursday's jail oversight board meeting, the warden seems to have reversed his prior stance and said that the jail oversight board can now have access to all of the jail's unredacted policies. However, the county has still not said whether or not the board is going to have access to some of the other documents that we used in our reporting about the jail and its mental health policies. So it's unclear how much the board is going to be provided in the coming weeks and months.
Juliette Ryle is a reporter at publicsource.org looking into mental health and the use of restraint chairs at the Allegheny County Jail. Juliette, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Save Our Stages Act, passed late last year, will offer $15 billion in grants to music venues, producers, promoters hit hard by the pandemic. But for some local venues, including the Rex Theater in the South Side, this funding comes too late. Katie Moran is artist manager for Opus One Productions, a Pittsburgh-based promoter, concert producer. Katie, welcome to the Confluence.
Thanks for having me.
Katie, what was it like to see local venues, including the Rex and others, go under?
And, you know, it's been an extreme challenge to navigate this past year, as it has for everybody. But venues are in a unique position when it comes to this pandemic. You know, we were the first to close, and we're going to be the last to reopen. When this pandemic started, you know, everybody had expenses and bills on the books. And those don't just go away. Only the revenue went away. The music industry is an ecosystem, and we all need each other.
The National Independent Venue Association came together to lobby Congress for the stimulus money. When you heard about this group forming, did you think it would be successful?
I thought that it would be successful in as a networking tool where venues could share, hey, I decided to do this with, you know, I talked to my bank and this was an option for me. I was able to get this sort of grant to cover my payroll for the next couple of months. Sharing information and hardships just so that we all had more information of how to navigate, because no one's ever done anything like this.
I have to ask you, you know, you're an artist manager, a promoter. I mean, performers, I mean, don't they feed off of that live in-person audience? And how are they doing? How are performers doing if they have to perform before this virtual audience?
That's where the magic comes from, you know? And some people are finding their ways of doing it, and some people aren't doing it at all. I know a lot of acts that just want nothing to do with the online performances. They don't want to do the virtual concerts. They're finding ways around it, whether it's streaming old shows that were recorded or you know, just hunkering down in the studio and writing, but it's just not the same.
Katie, I want to ask you, how has your job changed during the pandemic as an artist manager, as a promoter?
Well, how much time do we have? It's completely different. I've been in this industry in Pittsburgh for about 10 years, overall closer to 15. And I've never experienced anything like this in my life. Well, the first steps was to dismantle everything we had built, whether it's, you know, shuttering our venues or clearing a calendar, even just pulling all the bar stock. It was really strange for the first like 3 to 6 months to rip apart everything that we've built. And then the next steps are just kind of like, okay, how do we keep the lights on? How do we move forward? How do we keep expenses as low as possible? So everything that I'm doing at this point, it's a lot of shuffling. I'm rebooking shows for the third, fourth, fifth time, trying to balance keeping the bands that we work with happy and active and keeping our customers happy as, you know, mm-hmm. as much as we can, just trying to navigate and lay low. And it's been tough. Like everything that I do every day is negative. It's a battle. It's canceling. It's fighting with a customer. It's fighting, you know, and that's not how this is. That's not what the music industry is. You'll have that at some points, but for it just all to be bad, it's pretty draining. Mm. You don't get that release of a live show because, you know, all the hard work, it's worth it whenever you see it all come together, and just that you don't have that aspect of it.
Fingers crossed. Let's be optimistic that there are some shows third and fourth quarter. Can you tell us about some amazing music we can maybe optimistically look forward to?
I'm hoping that a lot of the stuff that we had on our calendar last spring will be able to resurface. I know we had a lot of cool shows, a couple of They Might Be Giants. We had Black Pumas booked. We had a Common Heart show at Stage AE Outdoors. We're hoping we can make that happen as soon as possible. There's going to be a lot. The good news is when shows can return and, you know, things are quote unquote normal, it's going to be back so strong. Everyone is just chomping at the bit to get going again. And hopefully the fans can wait it out.
Katie Moran is an artist manager for Opus One Productions, a Pittsburgh-based promoter and concert producer. Katie, thanks for joining us and good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.